I'm Kip Gardner. I currently live in Northeast Ohio. I have been here since 2001. Prior to that, lived in Southeastern Virginia and grew up in Minnesota. So I've experienced life in a number of parts of the world. I kind of one of those kids that grew up in the woods, and that led to a career in science. That has morphed in a number of different ways over the years. Kind of currently has put me in a position where I am putting most of my effort towards teaching at the college level, mostly environmental science, and I'm also operating and attempting to develop a small farm that, you know, I'm working on along restorative and regenerative agriculture principles.
Okay, so I've heard you, I think one of the things that first intrigued me when you and I got on social media together is that I hear you refer to yourself with some regularity as a former climate scientist. And I'm curious what the former means. I mean, you're still a scientist, you've got training in climate stuff, and it feels like a little bit of kind of distancing from the field. And so I'm curious why you characterize yourself that way. What does the former mean?
Well, I think this kind of what this kind of has its genesis in is a lot of people really don't understand or fully appreciate that science is one of those things where it's kind of like medicine. If you aren't a continuous practitioner, you really become disassociated from whatever is happening in that particular discipline. And so I have not, you know, been a contributing researcher to climate science for nearly 20 years now. I went on to do other kinds of research before I stopped doing research. I'm not current in, you know, in terms of being a day-to-day researcher.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so I don't feel I can competently say I am a climate scientist at this point, because I'm not contributing data to the discipline. I'm not keeping up with the level of literature that would be necessary to do that. You know, I still have the expertise, and I apply that in my teaching, and I apply that in my advocacy work, and I certainly keep up at some level with what my former colleagues are doing, but I'm not, you know, day-to-day doing that kind of work. And I do have to keep up with a certain amount of what other people are doing in the discipline, because it, of course, it impacts how I teach what I teach.
Right,
so
right.
In that sense, you know, I'm keeping current to some degree, but not to the level that, you know, I would have to, mm-hmm. you know, as a day-to-day researcher.
Right, right. So if we could rewind the clock a little bit back to 20 years ago when you were up to your eyeballs in the data of climate stuff, what would you have said at that point if somebody had said, so what's the prognosis around climate change? What would you have said 20 years ago?
I would have said pretty much not too much different from what I say now, which is we are in very deep trouble. People do not appreciate the enormity of what we are doing to the planet. And this is a process where things done 50 years ago are just now starting to have an impact. Things that were doing, you know, that were done in the early 2000s, will start having an impact in a few years. The huge increases in greenhouse gas emissions that have occurred over the past 20 years, we really haven't seen the impact of what those are going to do yet.
Mm-hmm.
Almost everybody I worked with in the field 20 years ago still says pretty much the same thing, which is we are in dire circumstances, and you know, our political system, our economic system, is just not in any kind of position to cope with what we're really facing. Mm-hmm. I think the only thing different I would say would have said 20 years ago is I would have had a slightly more optimistic outlook on what was possible to do to address the changes that we're going to be seeing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Some things that are now inevitable that wouldn't necessarily have been inevitable 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting.
I also think I wouldn't have said 20 years ago that we're out of time. We are now, I say, we are out of time to start doing something substantive about changing this.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, I'm not a scientist. I am a spawn of scientists. Both my parents are scientists by training, but I started tracking it in probably about 1987 was the first time that I really tuned into it. And at that point, you know, we were calling it, you know, the greenhouse effect and then, you know, global warming and then climate change. So the language
global
has changed
warming.
Over time. The way that I talk about it as somebody who's been tracking it, but not really with a scientific background, is that it seems like the, I call it the incredible shrinking timeline. Like, you know, both, it seems like we keep hearing more and more about how things are happening faster than we thought they were, and that they're worse sooner than we thought they were. And of course, we're also progressing forward in like literal time. So it's sort of, it feels like the ends are sort of meeting and colliding in a lot of ways right now, where we're sort of into the brunt of it, where in 1987, most of what we were seeing was like, someday in the far future, something bad is going to happen. And now it's like, oh no, we are really very much in the midst of the bad things that are happening, and it seems like it's only going to get worse. I mean, does that seem like a pretty accurate summary?
I think in terms of the general understanding of it, yes. I would say most of us who worked in the field or work still in the field were pretty pessimistic about how rapidly this would unfold and how rapidly we would be impacted by the mid-1990s at the latest, because we saw where things were going, and we also saw that nobody was paying attention to where things were going, that for whatever, you know, political or economic reasons, nobody really wanted to seriously address this. And globally, we still aren't. You know, I every time I hear some country announce that they, you know, are setting a goal of being, you know, 100% renewable energy by 2050, I find, you know, I say, well, that's a ridiculous goal. You know, we're you know, as positive a movement as the Paris agreements were, they fall far short of what needs to happen, you know, and nobody really wants to address those because, quite honestly, I think, you know, from on the political side, you know, as a scientist observing the political side, I think most of the political establishment, regardless of ideology, is completely terrified of the implications of all this.
So it's better to just not think about it.
They just simply don't want to address it because it will cost them, you know, to be honest about it, will cost them votes, it will call into question our economic system, it will do a whole range of things that none of them, you know, with just a few exceptions, want to even consider. So, you know, as a scientist, it gets rather frustrating to, you know, constantly be saying this is where we are, and you know, it's like, you know, yelling to the Grand Canyon in terms of any kind of response. And I think every scientist who works in this field, you know, feels that to some degree. To be perfectly honest, in terms of, you know, what I still hear from former colleagues and whatever,
we're
just not being heard.
Right. And as scientists, of course, you're supposed to be like objective and non-emotional about everything. But like, how is that possible? And it seems like I have multiple friends that have sort of gotten out of the field for various reasons. But one of those reasons is definitely like the sort of daily contact with despair and with being ignored at some point. It really starts to eat at you.
Yeah, and the whole question of despair, I think, is really crucial to all this. And I think that's, you know, and to address that at a couple, you know, personal level, but also a societal level, I really think we need to be honest that that's something we really need to acknowledge. Because I guess the way I would put it is, you know, if you insist on denying that there's something to despair about, then perhaps you will, in that way, that denial will actually bring about the thing that you are feeling despair about.
Right.
For lack of being able to really, you know, look at what the situation is and do whatever is possible. At a personal level, you know, I have a whole range of feelings around that. I definitely feel despairing at times, and I guess I allow myself to do that because, you know, it feels like there are certainly the circumstances are potentially dire enough to warrant that. I also, it allows me to, you know, I feel a great deal of sorrow about what is happening. But I take a longer view and I say, well, you know, maybe certain things will happen that are inevitable that we can't do much about. As a scientist, as somebody who has studied, you know, everything from the micro to the macro to the universal, you know, the Earth will continue, you know, beyond this particular point in time, whether we're part of that process or not. You know, life has proven very resilient on this planet. You know, we know of at least five major mass extinctions in the last, you know, 600, 700 million years. And life bounces back each time. So, you know, I don't like to contemplate things like extinction of ourselves or many of the species we share the planet with, but that's a definite possibility, and it's one of the things that many of us are concerned about. But, you know, I also feel that it's entirely possible to look at it and say, well, this is just one in a long series of changes that the world has undergone, and you know, it's not always pleasant to contemplate certain things, but you know, there in another 10 million years, you know, there will be something different here anyway.
Right.
Which I know is probably not an attitude that a lot of people, you know, want to take, but
right. But it's you being real as a scientist.
Kind of, yeah. And you know, life persists. You know, we know this. This is something that, you know, looking at the 4 billion year history of the planet, you know, brings home to anybody who is, you know, professional in the field, or even, you know, an avid lay person who wants to understand what's going on around them. You know, I deal with that on a daily basis in teaching, because at some point, you know, when we talk these topics in class, the students start to go, oh, wait a minute, you know, this is really bad. Sometimes they connect the dots and say, you mean we as a species could, you know, be in a process of extincting ourselves, and yes, we could be. And so it's something that comes into people's awareness rather shockingly if they've never thought about it before.
Right.
And so I have to process that, you know, over and over and over again in the course of teaching.
There's a parallel for me where I feel like I do a similar thing where I bounce between like sort of geologic time perspective and human suffering time perspective, and those are vastly different perspectives.
Yes.
On the whole thing. And
yes.
I think there's to some extent, I think it's a coping mechanism that, like, you know, I understand geologic time well enough and I understand these mass extinction cycles well enough to know that what you're saying is really true, that like life is a very persistent thing on this planet, and that it, you know, it's the clinging to human survival, I think, that is where we get into that, the sort of bigger picture suffering. You know, there's the personal suffering. You know,
yes.
I have a friend who just lost her home in a hurricane, and she has no insurance, and so her family is about to start over with nothing. And that is like real-time personal human suffering that's happening one degree of separation.
Absolutely.
For me. And I think that there's like a tightening circle. It feels like if we haven't already been personally hit with it, we're like the personal hits are getting closer and closer to each of us, I think. And that's a really different thing than, it's easier to sort of step back into like, well, and this happens on the planet, you know, every you know, however many million years. Yeah.
And absolutely, as just another person amongst the 7 billion or so of us, I fully agree with what you're saying. And you know, that longer view does not negate the fact that, on the whole, I enjoy being a living human being, and I know that most people want things that I want, and that we want life to continue for ourselves, and that everybody deserves that, and all the rest, and that this is, as you say, that tightening circle. I lived for over 30 years in Norfolk, Virginia. I still have strong emotional ties to Norfolk. I still have lots of friends who live there, and I deal every day with the realization that particular city, like many others, may well no longer be habitable in my lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
That it will literally, disappear beneath the waves. And that affects me very personally, to think that a place I counted as my hometown for a good part of my life will cease to exist.
Mm-hmm.
And the suffering and dislocation and problems that will cause for literally millions of people, mm-hmm. Including many that I'm still close to. So yeah,
right.
There's no question.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things that I think is kind of difficult for me to deal with here in Ohio is that much of what is currently happening, we're kind of, and this is to get the ideas across to students, we're kind of buffered from some of that here.
Mm-hmm.
We don't get the extreme weather. We don't get, these horrible events that force people out of their homes. And so it gets a little hard for people here to connect emotionally, I think, unless somebody they know is personally affected.
Mm-hmm.
In another part of the country.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting.
So,
I had friends who...
that's another piece to all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. I had friends... I think it was last summer. It might have been the summer before. I might have still been at Dancing Rabbit, actually, when I did this. But I realized that I had friends dealing with flooding in one part of the country and friends dealing with fires in another part of the country. And I was like, I'm pretty well networked, but I'm not that well networked. And so I actually sat down and I ran some quick and dirty, back of the envelope kind of stats on what was actually happening. And during 1 week, I think it was in the summer of 2016, there was literally 1% of the U.S. population was dealing directly with some kind of climate related disaster.
Uh-huh.
And it was
that's
like 1 in 100 of us. And I knew, and of course, even, I have 2,000 Facebook friends. So of course I know multiple, and it's and you start looking at that kind of thing and just going oh, wow, this is really happening. It's not some future thing.
Yep. Yeah, it is really happening. And, people are just getting... I think part of what's happening, that what you call a tightening circle, the other piece to that is reality is starting to catch up with the denial. And so we're seeing that in Florida, and I no longer have family in Florida, but I pay some attention to what goes on there. And I don't know, how quickly the shift will occur, but it's quite clear that what people are experiencing day to day, especially those folks who are living right on the coast, does not match with what they're being told by their, those in political authority. And that's going to cause, that's a disconnect for people that they hadn't, they previously, that wasn't part of their daily experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's going to start having, I think that's, going to start having a bigger and bigger and bigger impact. As you say, these things happen on a more frequent basis, and just to put a number to it, 1% of the population is 3 million people, This is just the beginning, you know. That's the other thing, you know, this is just the beginning. Dr. Hansen, you know, is still doing work. He's no longer with NASA, you know, he basically is now working, you know, with a independent research group, but, you know, as even 2 years ago, they were already saying the preliminary data, you know, coming out of Antarctica from their research suggests somewhere between a 6 and 10 foot sea level rise by the middle of the century,
mm-hmm.
which is far greater than any official report acknowledges. You know, as you mentioned earlier, it seems as though, you know, what most of my former colleagues are observing now is, in fact, the changes are accelerating. That what, you know, we would have said, oh, that will happen 100 years from now, or, you know, 500 years from now, people are saying, no, that's likely to happen much sooner, and the impacts will occur sooner. And sea level rise is just one.
Mm-hmm.
It's one that people are starting to pay attention to because of work like Hansen's group, but also that every summer the news out of Greenland gets worse.
Right.
The levels of melting are greater than had previously been recorded,
mm-hmm.
and that the trend is towards faster and faster melting every year. And so we're having to readjust, or they, you know, having to readjust the models to or providing new data to the models that, you know, is starting to bring back some pretty alarming predictions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we've just recently, you know, the other thing is, and this goes to the political, you know, for many years, what we fought in climate change science was the politicians would say, oh, well, everything you're talking about is just predictive based on these computers that you guys keep talking about. And, you know, and the whole climate gate scandal, you know, 10 years ago was kind of around that, the allegations that, you know, scientists were manipulating data to make the models produce more dire predictions than were, you know, warranted. And what we're finding is in, you know, continued work with those models is they're actually getting highly predictive, and that the models that have the best track record of being predictive are also predicting the worst possible changes.
Mm, interesting.
So, you know, as I say, we have, you know, to use kind of a hackneyed phrase, we have shifted on this whole issue in
mm-hmm.
the past 5 years or so.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And people have not woken, and that's why I said, you know, when we started off early, why I now, you know, routinely say we are out of time to address this. And I guess, you know, and we are going to have to, the other thing, and even my textbooks that I teach from now are admitting this or bringing this into the conversation in the classes we teach, is that some of the changes that 20 years ago we were saying might happen, now we are saying they will happen.
Mm-hmm.
There is
mm-hmm.
is no way to stop them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, other worse things, there's maybe a possibility we can mitigate still, but there are certain things that are pretty much already set.
So Kip, as a college professor, I mean, I have a number of people in my life who were sort of traumatized by education experiences around environmental stuff, and some of them it was a much younger age than the students that you're working with, but I wonder, is there any possibility that colleges are going to start pairing all of this scientific data with any kind of, like, and here's how to actually deal with your emotions around this stuff, or is it still pretty much like, here's the data, figure it out for yourself, kids, good luck?
You know, I don't know that there's anything being, and I can't, I guess I'd say don't know. I haven't heard too much in terms of anybody suggesting that at an institutional level as policy. I think many of us who teach the subject are clearly aware of the impact, and I certainly don't just throw it out there and say, you know, good luck.
Uh-huh.
I do try in my own teaching, I do try to say, okay, this is, you know, not only just here's the data and figure it out for yourself, but here's, I teach environmental science, you know, to use current popular jargon in a very intersectional way.
Mm-hmm,
I talk about the tie-in with racism and sexism and income inequality and all of these issues, and try to get people to show that we have to look at the impact of, we can't just say, you know, figure it out. We need to start looking at this as we as a human community do need to start addressing this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that hearing that from somebody who, you know, is in a position of being an instructor, is helpful, because I try to communicate the idea that, you know, you're not just being, you know, as you said, the trauma, you're not just being thrown out there alone to cope with this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I try to provide, you know, examples of how you can take this information and work with other people to do something about it.
Mm-hmm, great.
And, you know, that, I think, is a little bit of a shift that I do myself. I think other instructors are somewhat, you know, starting to see that that's an approach that's worthwhile and perhaps necessary.
One of the ways that you and I are connected, I mean, the original way that you and I are connected is through our mutual interest in intentional communities. And I'm curious what the relationship is for you between that interest and climate issues. I mean, is community part of a climate fix? It sounds like you're convinced we're sort of past a point of at least minimal return, if not no return. Or is it a way to deal with inevitable changes? Or is it a way of creating comfort for people as things are changing around them? Or what is the relationship between those two things for you?
I think at one level there's a little of all three of those. Yes, community can be a response to climate change. Yes, it can be a way for taking some action to help mitigate in a way that people can, you know, feel mutual support in the face of what is likely to occur. So I think all of that is true. I think at a more important level is the idea that community is really the only effective response to the various, to use a phrase, you know, an old phrase, the various slings and arrows of existence, regardless of what's happening with the climate. We have seen in the past 100 years, for example, that capitalism has reached a point where it is a failing humanity as an economic system, and that idea that, you know, we are looking at those of us who have come to realize that, you know, are looking at transforming our relationship to sustenance, which is really what the economy is about,
mm-hmm.
To, you know, what some people call a resource-based economy, so that we're meeting human needs is the goal of work and production, not the accumulation of profit, and I see a very strong interreaction between that kind of a philosophy and the idea that we need to be living cooperatively.
Nice.
Because, you know, we can, and I don't necessarily, I guess, and I'm still evolving on all this, but I don't necessarily, we have to completely say, well, that, you know, there's we have to do away with you know, any kind of personal benefit for expended effort or whatever. You know, I guess, and maybe to give you a concrete example, you know, I run a small farm. I currently don't and have not had employees because I do not feel that at the current level of production and income of the farm, I can afford to pay anybody what it would be fair to pay them. So I won't do it. I operate the farm as a one-person operation. That does not, and as I look at that, I say, well, then the farm is my means of production. So, you know, to put it in Marxist terms.
You're socialist.
So I'm getting a benefit from my effort with my means of production. That does not mean that I also have to currently compete in a marketplace where there are other people selling similar kinds of products to the people who want them. So I guess that's kind of, you know, that it's an evolving and moving target for me, but it all fits together that some kind of cooperative community living arrangement also ties in with a transformation of our economic life as well. What will happen with that with regard to climate change? I don't know. I think it's, I almost at this different level, I say it's necessary regardless of what happens with climate change. You know, I think perhaps people who move in that direction might be in a better position to, you know, cope with whatever occurs over the next 20, 30, 40 years. But I don't think, for me, to some extent, climate change is only a piece of why I might be interested in a more community-based, communitarian way of living.
So,
yeah, so that's, I guess, where I would go with that.
Great.
And I think the other piece, I mean, there is a tie-in because one of the huge things that has to occur to start getting a handle on the things that we are doing to drive climate change is to reduce consumption. We simply cannot continue to consume the resources of the planet at the level we are. One of the, you know, I think many people have recognized at various times, and I've probably even heard you say something about it at some point. It comes up in places like the community conferences that, you know, that the excessive consumption that is is a hallmark of American society and to some extent Europe and the rest of the developed world is in fact a response to our disconnection from each other.
Yeah.
And, you know, and you see this, of course, in communities that, you know, if you've had a chance, and I think you have, I believe, you know, if you travel to other parts of the world where people don't enjoy the level of economic affluence that we do, there are often much stronger bonds of community and personal interaction that work to fulfill some of the needs that we try to fulfill with consumption. And that is a big thing that needs to change. You know, and unfortunately, the, you know, capitalism is predicated on encouraging people to consume, and we simply can't do that any longer with the evidences around us every day.
So what are your own community dreams out there in Ohio? What are you hoping to turn that farm into?
Some things that I've been contemplating over the last couple of months, I think I would like to see the farm become some sort of cooperative venture and living community in the next few years. I don't know how that's going to come about or how it's going to develop, but it's one thing I'm considering. I know, and I guess one of the things that's driving that is, you know, I own the farm. You know, I don't owe money on it. So it's like, okay, I know one of the big barriers to forming community is access to land and dwellings. And I always lose track of how old I'm. I'll be turning 61 this fall. You know, and I'm already looking at, well, you know, how it's getting a little harder every year to run this place as a one person operation. It would be nice to have people there who shared common goals and aspirations. On a larger level, it's kind of funny, but even though I've owned the farm for nearly 8 years now, I still have a hard time wrapping my head around the legality of ownership. You know, I'm aware that land has supported life, you know, ever since the glaciers retreated from it 8,000 years ago, and that it's only been for the last 200 years that this legal fiction we call ownership has been imposed upon it. Right now, I look at that ownership as more that is my obligation to see this land continue to thrive into the future, even though my tenure and ownership of it is entirely transitory.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so building community both for people but for the planet is kind of my hope, and in particular my, being a place where that is modeled in one small spot on
nice.
Earth.
Okay.
So, that's the best way to state it.
Right, great. Okay, great. Well, thank you so much, Kip, for taking time to talk to me. I know you're super busy with the semester heating up and all, and really appreciate it.
Yeah, well, I certainly appreciate the opportunity to have the conversation with you, and it's always a pleasure, and I hope we'll have other conversations, at some other point in the future, so.
Great. Okay, sounds good.
Thank you, and,
all right.
And good evening.
We're taking on a big project here, and we need your help.
We are restoring this beautiful, huge house built in 1878, and the 3 acres of land it's on.
We're doing it so that it can be a cooperative, communal space for people to live, work, create, and do activism. There are many ways that you can help us, but the most mutually beneficial way is to subscribe to Solidarity House on Patreon.
Your subscription supports the effort to restore the house and the land, and it gets you access to tons of bonus material, including full unedited interviews, our original music, and more.
Please subscribe to Solidarity House and help us grow a commune out here.
We're Solidarity House on Patreon, and Solidarity House Cooperative on Facebook and Twitter.